In Wisconsin, the standoff does continue, though. Governor Scott Walker threatening to send pink slips to state workers today if Democrats who fled across the border don't return to pass his bill, which Democrats say would decimate the public worker unions by making dues voluntary and requiring unions to face a certification vote every year, and most important, stripping workers of their right to collective bargaining. In polls this week, across the board, a strong majority of Americans support workers' rights to collective bargain. But also interesting to us, a large number of Americans aren't even sure what that is or what unions do. In the 1960s, one in four workers in the U.S. was in a union. Now it's one in eight. So let's get a primer. The first American union was created in 1794. Philadelphia shoemakers, they were called cordwainers. They couldn't feed their families. They went on strike. But the courts not only fined them, they made them pay for their own trials. Well, things changed. Bruce Laurie is Professor Emeritus of Labor History at the University of Massachusetts. He joins us from WFCR in Amherst, Mass. Bruce, when did things start to change?
Craft workers, skilled workers, were organized fully in the 1880s in the American Federation of Labor. They were a relatively thin slice of the workforce.
And we understand this. They were organized by a fellow named Samuel Gompers, who, by the way, his name is trending high on Google, on Twitter. Young people are giving shout-outs to him. Here's one, Samuel Gompers, you're the boss.
Wow.
This is happening online. Tell us about Samuel Gompers.
Gompers was an English Jew who migrated here in the early 1860s. He was a cigar maker by trade who worked in downtown New York and who developed fairly close relationships with German Marxists. As time wore on, the 1870s and 1880s, he abandoned Marxism, but he never left unionism and became the founding father of the American Federation of Labor.
Which grew to the AFL-CIO, which is it's an umbrella organization. So tell us what that is.
The CIO piece of it was formed in the middle of the 1930s in the midst of the Depression. CIO unions, Congress of Industrial Organizations more broadly, represented auto workers, steel workers, rubber workers, electrical workers, machinists, workers part of the industrial regime that the AFL had largely ignored. They organized in the mid-30s and came together as a CIO with the help of the Wagner Act. The Wagner Act in 1935 is the first time that the federal government conferred the right to organize on American workers, one of the last major industrial nations in the world to do that.
And Bruce, tell us a little bit about why this movement started. I mean, I know we're giving a quick overview, but, you know, we know, for instance, Wisconsin was a place where there was a battle for an eight-hour workday. And some people, some young people today have said to me, you're kidding. You mean you needed to fight for that? So tell us about some of the things that workers were facing, which made them turn to unions.
In the 1930s, the unemployment rate soared to 25%. There's massive unemployment in the nation, and the federal government offered virtually no benefits. Workers thrown out of jobs were fully dependent on charity of one kind or another. So there was no safety net in the 1930s until the Social Security Act is passed in 1935, and it doesn't go into effect until the early 1940s. They're also worried about pay. There are massive wage cuts in the course of the 1930s. Seniority and security, and a say in how things were done on the shop floor.
Well, and this history is a bloody one.
It's the bloodiest history of any nation. Between 1870 and 1910, either cops, policemen, local police, militia, or the federal government were called out 500 times to suppress strikes or prevent labor violence.
I'm going to tick through some. There was the Haymarket Riot in Chicago. They were fighting for a shorter workday.
8-hour day.
Yep, that was 1886. Several people died. The Battle of Cripple Creek in Colorado. Miners fighting owners who had increased their workday without upping their pay.
Yeah, well, that was very common.
The Atlanta washerwoman strike, 2 decades after the Civil War. Thousands of black laundry workers striking for higher wages. So there have been these benchmarks. Unions gained strength, you know, because, again, they were fighting for things that we now take for granted, an eight-hour workday. And tell us a little about the way they work. Union members pay dues. They hold elections to determine union officers. And they bargain through those officers? How does it work?
There are two levels. There is the federal level. Federal level handles almost all private sector workers, plus federal workers. The other level is the public sector in the states. And in each state, there are labor boards, and labor boards handle public sector workers in the states. Unions in both instances are formed through elections. They're called unit determination elections, in which people get together. They decide whether they want to have a union. When so many people decide they want a union, an election is held. Once the results are in, the union is certified if it prevails in the election. The earliest union contracts in the 1930s had basically several provisions. One was seniority. Workers were really concerned in a period of high unemployment for job security, and so the modern seniority clauses are born in the 1930s. Second, grievances. There was no easy way of resolving disputes between management and labor in this period, and especially in the 1920s, and so unions developed grievance procedures whereby management and labor come together to resolve their differences. Differences aren't resolved at the lowest level between management and labor. The grievance would go to arbitration, and an outside expert would come in and make a ruling. What developed here is a system of sort of industrial jurisprudence, whereby management and labor figured out a way to resolve disputes between them. The third area, obviously, was wages.
Well, and what about collective bargaining? This is one of the things that Republicans are trying to chip away at in many states. Explain collective bargaining.
Modern collective bargaining is really born in the 1930s and 40s. Contracts would run 1 to 3 years, depending on the industry, and in rare instances, 5 years. Management and labor sat down, experts sit down. Mostly this is done by lawyers, I might add. Even as early as the 1940s, lawyers largely are negotiating union contracts. The earliest contracts dealt largely, as I say, with grievances, seniority, and wages. In the 1940s, union contracts took a radically different turn, and they began to include benefits and cost of living increases. So by 1955, contracts in mainstream industries included provisions for health care, pensions, holidays, the package of things that today we call benefits. They're really born in the 1940s.
And don't now teachers, for instance, bargain over class size, materials? Police can collectively bargain over protective gear or other working conditions?
In the modern day, there are three areas of union activity. One continues to be wages and benefits. The second area is what you refer to. I would call it conditions. Conditions at work having to do for police and firemen with uniforms, with protective gear. Bargaining over conditions gives working people a say in their work environment and in how much work they do under certain conditions. The third area of union activity is political support. All unions, public sector and private sector, have funds, and those organizations contribute substantial amounts of money to political organizations in order to further their support in Congress and in the states.
Welcome back to our thumbnail on unions, prompted by new polling that shows that while a majority of Americans support the right for unions to bargain collectively, many other Americans aren't even sure what a union is. We have unions to thank for the 8-hour workday, minimum wage laws, the fact that child labor is illegal. These are fights immortalized in films like Norma Rae and Harlan County, USA. But workers have also felt pressure to join unions. Union corruption was at the center of the 1954 film On the Waterfront. Here's Marlon Brando playing a dock worker who testifies against a corrupt union boss, played by Lee J. Cobb, and then confronts him.
You think you're God Almighty, but you know what you are?
Come on!
You're a cheap, lousy, dirty, stinking mug! And I'm glad what I've done to you! You hear that? I'm glad what I've done! I'm going to keep on doing it until I get...
Come on!
Come on! Movie. Bruce Laurie is Professor Emeritus of Labor History at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And Bruce, where, in your opinion, did unions misstep? Start with corruption.
The union got involved with some with organized crime, some with petty criminals. As a result, there were investigations in the 1950s, and it was all over the news, all over the newspapers. I can remember as a young man... looking at the New York Daily News with a photo of Dave Beck from the Teamsters holding up his hand, not to say hello, but it meant he was taking the Fifth Amendment. So many of them refused to speak, and several went to jail. The aftermath of it was that unions were seen as corrupt, although the majority of the population was still supporting unions into the 1970s.
Well, and then that brings us to the 80s, when Ronald Reagan was seen as a hero by some for busting the air traffic controllers union. But I want to move forward to what seems to be, or we thought was, I mean, some of the recent opinion polls say differently, but a sense that unions were responsible for work moving overseas because unions were rigid about wages, that unions were, as a talk show host Mike Rosen says of Wisconsin's unions, defending their Rice Bowl and their self-interest. You know, as teachers said on the front page of the New York Times this week, how did we get to be reviled? How did that happen?
Unions have always been a favorite target of the American right, a movement developed in the 1940s to pass right-to-work laws in the states. These laws make it very difficult for unions to organize. 1940s into the 1950s, almost all southern states and several western states had right-to-work laws on the books. But anti-unionism really never became a more general cause, even among Republicans. The Republican platforms into the 1950s identified unions as a good thing. It wasn't until the 1970s and 1980s that conservatives began to make anti-unionism a cause célèb on their side.
Well, now bringing us up today, you have Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker and governors in other states addressing the public unions, saying that they're trying to cut budgets. So many, I'll cite New York Times columnist David Leonhardt as one, point out that unions have already agreed to a significant cut in their wages and their benefits, that the sticking point is collective bargaining. But what else do you see happening here?
This is a watershed moment for American unions, public sector unions especially, but also possibly for public sector workers at large. The 1970s into the 1980s was a period of gradual loss of membership in private sector unions. As a result, by the 1990s and today, there are more public sector workers organized than private sector workers. The private sector losses had largely to do with runaway shops.
Shops that moved?
Yes. In the North, right after the major contracts were signed in basic industry during the 1930s, industries began to move from union-friendly terrain in the North into the Sun Belt in the South. The emergence of developing world economies between 1978 and 1982, China opened up, India opened up, and so the next stop for American manufacturers looking to save on wages was to move to the developing world.
So that greatly reduced the private sector union membership. So now you have these public sector unions. But Bruce, do you think that public sector unions have to make some cuts in their benefits?
All public sector unions have been making concessions in the first decade of this century. The workers in Wisconsin and in other areas have already agreed to substantial concessions. In Texas, for instance, public sector teachers haven't had a raise since 2001.
Peter Scheer, an executive director of the First Amendment Coalition, says that the problem with public employee unions is that instead of working on behalf of the people, these unions have morphed into special interest groups that dump money onto candidates instead of fighting for change. We know that unions support candidates. But after the Supreme Court's recent decision opening up the flow of money from corporations, unions have actually dropped down. A union was only number 5 in support for candidates after the last election. The top 4 spots were taken by corporations. What do you think of the criticism that what is happening in Wisconsin and in other states is in fact an effort to make unions spend their money to defend themselves so that they can't contribute to largely Democratic candidates?
Well, that may be. The larger strategy, I think, is to abolish public sector unions. The public sector unions are a problem for conservatives, as they see it, because they are the major force that funds the Democratic Party. That's the beginning and end of it. The Supreme Court decision expanded the scope of corporate power. At the same time, the same people who applauded that decision are trying to destroy public sector unions. Now, the fact that this battle is concentrated so far in the upper middle West is really instructive. It turns out that the Democratic Party has decided that it can win the next election by winning back the upper middle West, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. If the Democratic Party can control those areas, it needn't organize the South. The South has been a historic problem for the Democratic Party because it's much more conservative. That's why this battle began in Wisconsin, why it's prevalent in Indiana, and why we're having that battle even to this day in Ohio. It's all got to do with political power.
There is so much more to this topic, and we will pick it up again. That's Bruce Laurie, Professor Emeritus of Labor History at the University of Massachusetts. Professor Laurie, Bruce, thanks so much.
Thank you.